I'm Mark Doyle, and I'm going to tell you a story. A story that's never been told in full before. One that stands out from the many tales of individual courage that took place during the genocide in Rwanda of 20 years ago. This is the documentary on the BBC World Service, and this is the story of Captain Mbai Dieng, a good man in Rwanda.
We went to the trucks. There were four white trucks with the UN flag. Now,
and Captain Mbai was organizing,
putting us in these trucks.
It's May 1994, a few weeks into the mass killings. Hundreds of thousands of people have already died. Captain Mbai Dieng, a United Nations peacekeeper from the West African state of Senegal, is in charge of an attempt to evacuate a group of about 70 people to safety. He's helped organise a convoy of trucks. The people are in the back of them. But the militia committing the genocide have other ideas. Dr. Odette Nyiramalimo was in one of the trucks.
We started driving to airport. Now there is a place they call Peage, and our truck was stopped there.
Stopped by who?
By a mob of militia. And all these militia, the people came with the machetes, with the stones. They said, go out, go out. And they tried to pull us out. And suddenly we saw Captain Mbai. He came and he said, no, stop. They said, no, these are cockroaches. We have to pull them out. Why are they leaving? And Mbai stood just like this behind our truck and he said, you are not taking them out. You only take them out after having killed me. I'm here now in front of you. You kill me first if you want to have these people go out.
I first met Mbai Dieng in April 1994 when I was reporting the genocide for the BBC. Most soldiers are wary of journalists, but this guy had an easygoing manner with me and with almost everybody else. And that, I believe, was what helped him on one occasion to save my own life.
We got stopped at a militia roadblock, and I should remind you at this point that the Belgian presence was considered by the government of the time to be an enemy presence. They thought the Belgians were with the rebels, as it were. So we were stopped at this militia roadblock, and a militia man leant in through the window of a 4x4, a bit like the one I'm sitting in now, and said to Mbai, who's this Belgian? And he stuck his head through the window, the side window here, and he stuck a Chinese stick grenade, which is a type of grenade that looks a bit like an old-fashioned sink plunger, but it's got a bomb on the end of it. And I was absolutely terrified, and Mbai looked him in the eye and told him a joke. He pointed at his black skin and said, look, I'm the only Belgian here. Look, black Belgian. And the militiaman smiled a bit, leaned back, and then suddenly Mbai said, this man is a British journalist, I am a United Nations military observer, and I'm going through this roadblock now. Get out my way. And I'm convinced that had he not cracked that joke, the grenade would have gone off.
These are stories I've wanted to tell for a long time, ever since I first met Captain Mbai. I knew some of the people he had saved from certain death, but now others have agreed to talk. So I'm going to tell the full story for the first time of this unsung hero. The scale of the killings in Rwanda was almost unimaginable. In total, some 800,000 people were killed in 3 months. That's an average of 8,000 a day, every day. The vast majority of them were ethnic Tutsis killed by the forces of an extremist ethnic Hutu regime. This is the story of a truly remarkable man, a soldier who, in the midst of this carnage, saved hundreds of lives.
He's standing there, not smiling, but confident. And he starts to brief me on what had happened there and all the other civilians. And they were all clustered around him. He was their sense of security.
the Canadian General Roméo Dallaire, the United Nations commander in charge of the peacekeeping mission in Rwanda back in 1994. He's recalling how he came across Captain Bai Dian near the house of the then Prime Minister of Rwanda, Madame Agathe Uwilingiyimana. The Prime Minister was a prominent opponent of extremists from the majority Hutu who committed the genocide. What Captain Bai told the General was catastrophic. The Prime Minister, whose house backed on to the United Nations residential compound the two UN officers were standing in, had just been murdered by government troops.
As he described to me, the extremists had made their way into the compound, had taken away the Prime Minister and her husband. There had been a grenade thrown and killing, and they had hidden the kids.
The kids. The Prime Minister's five children, aged at the time between 3 and 18. Captain Mbai knew the children were still alive, and he knew which house in the UN residential compound they were hiding in. By the end of that day, Mbai and others had smuggled the five children out of the UN compound and taken them to the relative safety of the Hotel des Mille Collines. And this is the Hotel des Mille Collines. From here in the car park, it's not much to look at, just an ordinary block of concrete and glass. But the Hotel des Mille Collines is today perhaps the most famous hotel in Africa because of its portrayal in the movie Hotel Rwanda. Hundreds of people sought refuge in the hotel during the genocide, a lot of them brought here by Captain Bai Dian. Ancilla Mukangira was working in 1994 for a German aid agency. When the genocide began, she knew her life was in danger. She was desperate to get out of the country, but soon realized that that would be impossible. And then, by sheer chance, she encountered two UN soldiers on the street.
One of them was Captain Mbai. I didn't know him at the time, but he came over to me and said, "Why are you crying? What are you doing here? If they see your looks, they'll cut your head off." I told him I had tried to register with the Americans for evacuation, but they'd refused because I'm Rwandan. At that, Captain Mbai suddenly got angry, and he said, "I can't believe they've refused you, that they've done that. It's not possible." Then he told me to get in his car.
They drove to the hotel. Ancilla remembers soldiers and militiamen at the entrance. They wanted to kill the Tutsis inside.
He rushed up the stairs. We didn't take the lift. We took the service stairs round the back. Then he quickly opened the door to his room and told me to go inside.
So Captain Mbai left Ancilla, this terrified young woman, in his room at the Hotel des Mille Collines.
He came back at the end of the day. He looked whacked, exhausted. Then we talked a bit. He saw me reading my Bible and he asked if I was a Christian. And I said yes. And he said I should pray for my country because awful things were happening.
By this time, Captain Mbai had been in Rwanda for several months. He'd made it his business to get to know commanders on both sides well. So when the killing started, he found himself in a unique position to negotiate. There were others who saved lives, of course, Rwandans as well as foreigners. And in the end, a Tutsi-dominated rebel force ended the genocide of 1994 by winning the conventional war against the Hutu extremists. But at the height of the mass killings, no single figure has emerged as being more active in saving lives than Captain Mbai Dian. But it goes further even than that. The United Nations bosses in New York were dithering about whether the UN force had a mandate to save Rwandans. Strictly speaking, they were only supposed to evacuate foreigners. But Mbai completely ignored that red tape. I never actually recorded an interview with Captain Mbai. Officially, he wasn't supposed to talk to journalists. But I have got hold of a home movie that he shot while serving in Rwanda. That's him now. He's wandering around with his camera, playing at being a reporter. interviewing his fellow peacekeepers. Occasionally, he hands his camera over to a comrade, then we get a glimpse of the man himself. He has a huge, gap-toothed smile and looks totally at ease despite the mayhem breaking around him. He's almost always got a cigarette on the go, in his hand or clenched between his teeth. One of the people who appears frequently on the 20-year-old home video is Mbaye's good friend and fellow Senegalese UN peacekeeper, the then captain, Babacar Faye. He's now one of the most senior officers in the Senegalese army, Colonel Babacar Faye.
You know, Mbaye Diagne, he was a guy who loved teasing people. He was always taking the mickey. He loved joking with everyone.
And this, says Colonel Faye, is what helped his friend do what no one else could as the daily massacres took place. Captain Mbaye was able to run the gauntlet of the militia roadblocks and bring people in his car to the safety of the Hotel des Mille Collines.
What he'd do sometimes, at the roadblocks where the killing was taking place, sometimes he'd joke with the killers. Sometimes he'd speak with their bosses. He was a very open sort of guy, you see. He liked sharing and talking. In his car, Mbaye Diagne would often have cases of beer or bottles of whiskey, you know, packets of cigarettes, money. He handed them out to get through the roadblocks. He handed out his military rations sometimes. In the end, we all cottoned on and we gave him extra rations for the job because the militiamen would say, "Boss, I'm hungry," or "Boss, I'm thirsty." And he'd give them something, a smoke or a beer, a whiskey.
But he was a Muslim. Mbaye was a Muslim. But he carried alcohol around in his car to give out to the militia,
yes,
to make friends with them.
Exactly.
He made out that he was their friend. That's how he saved people from being killed. That's the way he got through to houses where people were hiding without making the militiamen angry. Then on the way back to the hotel, he'd be able to get past again. He'd pick up five or six people at a time and bring them back in his car to the hotel.
How many people do you think that he saved? Do you have any idea?
You know, we don't have the statistics because, you know, he wasn't doing the sums. He was just acting the only way he knew how. But just at the Mille Collines Hotel, at least 200 or 300 were saved because of Mbaye Diagne. And then you've got all the others that he rescued. There must have been at least another 100. So that all adds up to what? 400 or 500 minimum people that were saved by Mbaye Diagne?
Are you sure about that? We're not creating a myth.
No.
I'm not creating a myth. It really was like that.
This is a district of the Senegalese capital, Dakar, called Komiko. It's not the most affluent part of the city. Every now and then, a horse-drawn cart rattles past, delivering bottled gas for cooking. This is where Yacine Diagne lives. She and Mbaye were married in 1988.
I'd never heard of Rwanda when he was sent there. When he phoned me, he told me about what was happening, and he said it was dangerous and that there were bodies in the streets. And every time we spoke, I said, "Please, be careful." But he said, "No, this is my job. I'm a soldier. This is my job."
Did he telephone you every day, or did you get letters, or how did it work?
We used to talk once a week. He'd ask about the children, he'd ask about our health, and I could hear the sound of shooting in the background, and I asked him what it was. He said it was dangerous there. He said he could get a bullet from anywhere, at any moment.
That must have been very, very worrying for you to hear that.
Yes, it was. I was very worried about him.
As well as causing the deaths of well over 500,000 people, the genocide marked the lives of countless more. Relatives, friends who lost loved ones, and many who fled the country. I'm travelling by train now around the shore of Lake Geneva in Switzerland to meet the daughter of the Prime Minister who was assassinated on the first day of the mass killings. The daughter's name is Marie-Christine Umuhoza, and she's never told her story in public before.
On arrive à l'hôtel, donc on est installé dans une chambre.
We arrived at the hotel and they put us in a room all together. They told us firmly not to open the door to anyone. And afterwards, every day more or less, we got a visit from this Captain Mbai. He didn't say much. He just came and checked on how we were. He didn't stay long.
Marie-Christine Umuhoza is a woman who has lived through a terrible trauma, but has somehow moved on. Now married with two children of her own, she talks about her time at the Mille Collines Hotel with remarkable poise. Remember, she was just 15 years old at the time and was being physically hunted by remorseless killers.
We were moved around a lot, from one room to another, down to the basement, into the toilet. Yes, there was a lot of that going on.
Marie-Christine remembers that at one point during those bewildering days in the hotel, she and the other children had got hold of a small radio set.
At one point, we heard on the radio that the Prime Minister had been killed along with her whole family. So we said to ourselves, they're saying we children are dead, but we are not dead, so it can't be true what they say about our parents either.
And when did you learn the truth?
Me personally, I don't know about my brothers, but I learned about it quite a while later, after we'd left Rwanda and had been in Switzerland.
We will never know exactly how many lives Mbai saved. An official estimate by the State Department in Washington puts it at 600. He didn't only save ethnic Tutsis, he made a point of letting hundreds of moderate Hutus find safety in the Hotel des Mille Collines too. But the Hutu hardliners were fed up with being thwarted by him and watching as he negotiated yet another car full of Tutsi refugees through the roadblocks. And they wanted him dead. Emmanuel Harindintwale is one of the killers from 1994. They're known in Rwanda as génocidaires. He's medium height, wearing jeans and sneakers. He stares me straight in the eye as he speaks. He manned a roadblock for several weeks on one of the main streets in Kigali. This man has served many years in prison for his part in the killings. And he remembers Captain Mbai.
He used to drive a car with a UN sign on it. And the militiamen and the soldiers at the roadblocks were afraid of the UN. So we respected him because he was in a UN car. There were some crazy guys at the roadblock who did try to stop him driving through. But he'd give them money, $100, $200, maybe even $400, and then they'd let him carry on.
Why didn't you stop him? He was your enemy. Yeah?
They did stop him. And then he'd get out of the car and go and talk to the people who had stopped him. He was a friendly kind of guy who knew exactly how to talk to people. And he was very persuasive. And once he'd persuaded them, you could see that they stopped being angry and they'd opened the roadblock and let him through.
My question is, did your bosses ever talk about trying to stop him?
Yes. They used to tell us that the Senegalese UN soldier might also be an accomplice of the enemy.
Was there ever any talk of trying to kill him?
Well, the way they looked at him, they wanted to kill him, but they couldn't find a way of killing him. They were scared the UN was monitoring everything and that they'd find out.
May the 31st, 1994, was the day Captain Mbai Diagne's luck ran out.
And there was Captain Mbai Diagne's car. I walked up to it. There was blood on the front seat. There were holes in the door where a grenade had exploded. It's believed he was killed by a mortar round that was fired from one of the surrounding hills here. And according to the UN commander who subsequently wrote a book about it, General Romeo Dallaire, he was dead before his head hit the dashboard.
He was bringing a message to my headquarters from the hardliners. I know he was bringing that because I got a piece of paper with some blood on it And so the message made it, but he didn't.
It has never been established for certain which side fired the mortar round which killed him. And in fact, it seems most likely it was a stray round, an accident. Mbai's wife, Yassine, remembers their last telephone call just a couple of days before he was killed.
Yes, it was on the Sunday. He rang me on the Sunday. We talked for a long time. He said his part in the mission would be over very soon. There are only 12 days left, he said, before I'll be back in Senegal. So you must pray for us. And he died on the Tuesday.
Do you remember anything else about that last conversation that you had?
Yes, he talked a lot about death. That's something that really upset me. He kept saying that death could come at any moment, but he said that you can only die once. That's what he said to me when we spoke on the telephone.
Did he used to talk like that before he went to Rwanda, or was it the terrible things that he saw in Rwanda that made him realise that, you know, you can die at any time?
I think that's right, because he never used to talk like that before. I think the things he saw over there deeply affected him. He'd seen so much that he no longer had any fear of death. That's what I think.
I saw evil in Rwanda in 1994, but I also saw extraordinary acts of courage by people who simply knew what was right and what was wrong. Mbai Dian was such a person, a good man in Rwanda. I asked Marie-Christine Umuhoza, the daughter of the murdered Prime Minister of Rwanda, what she thought of Captain Mbai Dian all these years later. This is what she said.
I think that he was a good person. For me, well, he died and I owe him my life. My brothers too. I think if he hadn't been there, I wouldn't be here now. I don't know. But let me say, I agreed to meet you and to talk like this because I wanted to pay a sort of tribute to him, to recognize and appreciate the things he did. Sadly, I can't say that to him directly, but I wanted to speak to honor his memory. Pour honorer sa mémoire.
A Good Man in Rwanda was written and presented by me, Mark Doyle, and the producer was Tim Mansell. To hear more documentaries in the series, go to bbcworldservice.com/thedocumentary.